L.W. Williams, Imperial War Museum, accession number 11542/4, reel 1.
Mr. Williams, reel 1. I think you joined HMS Amethyst in 1948.
That's correct. I joined the Amethyst 25th of June 1948.
In what capacity did you join her?
As engine room watchkeeping duties, as an ERA second class.
What kind of a ship was she to serve on?
She was a frigate with steam turbines and two boilers. Close-knit ship, good ship's company. I shall have to remember the tonnage, I can't...
Never mind the tonnage, but was your work in the engine room difficult or easy?
It was close. It was a packed little ship, you know, the machinery, pumps and evaporators and all that were close-knit, so you didn't have much room to work in, and the generators were very... The only one that wasn't working at the particular time was the diesel generator, which... was out of action even during the period of the Yangtze incident, which could have helped a terrific amount of with fuel, which we did have fuel troubles on the Amethyst during the time in captivity.
How many of you were working in the engine room?
We had. You mean at the time of the Yangtze incident?
Yes.
Well, at the time of the Yangtze incident, we had the Yangtze incident. We had personnel that were left was two engine room staff, another ERA besides myself, a mechanician, five stoker POs, and three leading stokers. And seven stoker mechanics. And later we recruited one EM1, which is an electrical mechanic, and a boy seaman who volunteered to become stokers because we were short of staff. Because at the time of the incident, when we got hit and badly damaged, we had one chief PO stoker mechanic killed, and five stoker mechanics were killed as well. The engineer officer and the chief engine room artificer and four stoker mechanics were very badly wounded. So, as you can see, it depleted our staff quite considerably.
Who was the person in charge of the engine room?
The person in charge of the engine room when we were steaming up the Yangtze was Lieutenant E. Wilkinson, who was the engineer officer. And then the chappie underneath him then was the chief ERA, Roblin, Stan Roblin.
What do you remember about steaming up the Yangtze before the incident occurred?
Well, we left Shanghai. I can't remember actually what time. I think it was about 8 o'clock in the morning. And then we had a Chinese pilot on board. And at that time, you was only allowed to steam up the Yangtze in daylight hours. And you had to anchor then at 5 o'clock at night. And then you could you could steam further up the Yangtze at daylight the next day, so you didn't steam up during darkness. And we were just steaming normally until the when we had the first salvo come over, and we had Union Jacks prepared then to drape over the side, both sides, to say that we were a British ship, because the Nationalists were one side, and the Communists were the other side, and of course we were steaming right up in between the two of them, and of course at any minute the Nationalists were expecting the Communists to invade across anyway.
Had you expected any trouble?
Well, I think we must have expected trouble, because of the fact that they had the Union Jacks prepared to drape over the side if anything did happen. So we were prepared in that instance, and you know the we'd practiced damage control and everything like that prior in case anything did happen.
Had you personally expected trouble?
No, I didn't personally expect trouble, no. No, not me.
So when the firing started, did it take you by surprise?
I think it did, because I was down on... I had the forenoon watch at that particular time, from 8 to 12, and of course it happened at, if I remember rightly, about 9 o'clock or 10 o'clock, I think, in the morning. And of course then the captain rang down full ahead, which... if a captain on any Navy ship rings down full ahead, it's an emergency. And, of course, he rang down full ahead. And then, of course, the next minute, we had a direct hit on the bridge, which seriously wounded nearly everybody on the bridge. And, of course, the wheelhouse, which takes the orders from the bridge, is underneath the wheelhouse, underneath the bridge. So, therefore, when they were hit up top, we were still at full ahead and nobody up there to bring it back until somebody got up there and told the wheelhouse. And by that time, one of the controls was jammed. So one engine was put to half ahead and to stop eventually, but the other one was still full ahead. So therefore, we swerved round and ran aground on Rose Island. And that's where we got stuck. And then, of course, we couldn't move. And they were just, we were a direct target when they were shelling at us.
Did any shells come through the engine room?
Not through the... Well, we had one through the... which is mentioned in this report. In through one of the turbo generators. But luckily, it only damaged the circulate water system, which we were able to patch up. But it didn't damage the generator, fortunately. We had one badly damaged in the stern, where we had a great big gaping hole, which took three or four hammocks to plug. But the shell came in, didn't explode, and didn't damage the steering gear, which was very fortunate.
What did it feel like where you were when the shells were hitting?
Well, you heard noise and banging onto the ship and things like that, but I suppose we were down below and we were so preoccupied with the handling of the ship and the engines, because, I mean, everything was at full throttle at that time, that you weren't so concerned at that particular time. And you was more concerned when the when I sent people up top to see what was happening. And, of course, the engineer officer went up top and came down and told us that they were shelling us, you know, while we were just stationary on the mud, which was a, you know, terrific thing. And you couldn't do anything about it at that particular time. And they stopped for quite a bit, and then until it got dark, and then we flashed up again, got full steam ahead again, and tried to get off the Rose Island. Well, I think we, if I'm right in saying that, we were flashed up at full steam then and going full ahead and full astern. We went full ahead on one engine and full astern on the other, so as to rock the ship, kept rocking it, and to make a passage for us so that we could get off. And I think I'm right in saying that we were doing that for about 8 hours, which was unusual, because normally you do damage to your ship when you're doing it for steaming full ahead for that particular length of time. And but eventually we did manage to slide off, and Lieutenant Weston then, who took over control, steamed it further about 4 or 5 miles up the river then, and of course, next day I think it was that particular point where they started to. He ordered, and they started shelling again. Then they ordered to abandon ship, and it was then at that particular point when people were abandoning ship and taking the wounded with them, when they started machine gunning them in the water, and then quite a few got ashore. And then they stopped the machine gunning in the water, and also, I won't say stop machine gun, they stopped abandoning ship because they were losing, getting so many casualties.
Where were you when...
We were still down in the engine room because of the fact that we were still flashed up. So we...
Flashed up?
Well, the term flashed up means to say we had full head of steam. And you naturally you couldn't go and leave a ship with people still on board with full steam up and full steam in the boilers and all the turbines moving or the pumps moving. All that had to be shut down to safety standards for damage control. So we still stopped on board. Ian McLash and the other engine artificer and myself were shutting down when the order came to stop abandon ship, so which was fortunate.
Going back to when the communists first opened fire, when you were down in the engine room and you didn't really know what was going on, did you guess what had happened?
We had a suspect then, I think, to think that things were that had gone wrong and that we shouldn't have been steaming up the Yangtze at that particular time, when the communists were so close to the bank of the Yangtze to invade across to the nationalist side. And we thought, although, thinking back, the consort, HMS Consort, was already up at Nanking anyway, and we were going up to relieve the consort, and the consort was coming down. So if we'd have got up there safe, then most probably the consort would have been in the same predicament as what we were in, coming down the river at that particular time.
How much fear was there below decks when the shelling started?
Fear.
How much fear?
Fear. I think with the older personnel, I don't think there was much fear. They were so intent on doing their duties at that particular time. But we had so many young seamen, boys seamen on board. I think we had, if I'm right in saying, about 8 or 9 boys seamen who were only 17. You know, and at that young age, having just joined the ship, because they'd only been on the ship a few weeks, and this sort of thing happening to them, you know, it's a bit fearful, isn't it? You know, to suddenly get shells and bullets and goodness knows what flying around you.
How did they react?
Very well indeed, very well. We had, in fact, they made a very, very good team after things calmed down a bit, because you know when you think that we had to when during the action we had if I remember rightly we had about 12 I think that we had to bury in the Yangtze, and those were put up and wrapped up in hammocks when eventually everything calmed down. And the first job that Commander Cairns had to do when he came on board to take over was to bury the dead at sea, over the Yangtze in the Yangtze itself. And Commander Cairns took the Church of England service, and the Chief Stoker took the, I think it was 3 Catholics that he buried. He took the service for that. And for the young boy seamen to see all that in their first, you know, few weeks of service is very harassing, isn't it?
Did you see any of the casualties occur?
Oh yes, yes, yeah.
Can you describe?
Well, I can. I've seen. We had one down the engine room, which was the Chief ERA who I mentioned, who was badly wounded, Chief ERA Stan Roblin. Naturally, when you're down the engine room and you go full ahead, full steam, the Chief ERA at that particular time always comes down the engine room and takes the other throttle, because you've got 2 throttles, port and starboard. And some incident happened at the back of the engine room, and Stan, the Chief ERA, went back to the after part of the ship, and at that particular time we had a direct hit on the after gun, and it came through the deck and splintered him all down the spine and down the legs. And from then on, I didn't see anything more until we'd shut down part of the engines and everything was a little bit quieter then. And we went to, Ian McLashan and myself went to search for him. and found him huddled up in a corner, you know, with blood and everything. We thought he'd had it, but luckily he survived, and he lives in Portsmouth with us. And he's, you know, crippled, and his legs are gone and partly, but he survived. And then when we came out of the engine room, after we'd shut down, when it was quieter, we found the Chinese pilot, who had been on the bridge at the time, been carried down just outside the engine room, in the engine room passage, with, you know, part of his face just literally blown away. And other people with both legs off, a chap named Williams, with both of his legs blown off. So it's namesake to me anyway.
What about the damage to the ship? What did that look like?
Very harrowing, but the point is that we had a lot of holes in the ship's side, but the most damage, I suppose, was on the bridge, where they had the direct hit on the bridge. But, you know, fortunately, no serious damage, no serious structural damage, which caused a ship that we couldn't sail, we couldn't steam around, which was fortunate. Yeah. In fact, in this particular report, it gives you the structural damage and all what we plugged up and with hammocks and goodness knows what.
Can you describe the repair work that you did?
Well, in the tiller flat, we had to shore up the hole in the tiller flat. We had one hole which caused structural damage inside the ship. This burst in the lobby between the depth charge locker and the wardroom store, distorting three bulkheads and blowing off the hatch above. Most of the shells appeared to burst on impact, causing large holes in the ship's side, but confining internal damage to that caused by splinters. As in the case of the electrical low power room, which was very severely damaged by splinters, owing to the many intricate fittings surrounding the bulkhead.
Did you take part yourself in the damage repair work?
Oh yes, we had to. That with the shipwright and electrical officers, electrical artificers, we had to more or less form a team to, because if we hadn't done that, I don't think we would have, you know, managed to steam further up the river at that particular time to, you know, quieten things down at that particular time.
What do you remember doing specifically yourself in the way of repair work?
I suppose the damage in the turbo generator room, which the shell came in and didn't damage. The freeing of the control from the wheelhouse to the engine room, which had stuck it full ahead. as I said before, the tiller flat damage, which had damaged the steering gear slightly, which we had managed to repair. But I suppose the most work we done was after we steamed further up the river and everything was a little bit quieter then, and we knew, well, we had a feeling that we'd be there for quite a while. Then we more or less got into a routine where we went through from forward to aft and checked everything and made a list of it to see which was priority and which was minor. To say if we did have to steam the ship out, then we knew which part had to be repaired first, because that was most important anyway, to make sure that the boilers and the turbines and the steering gear was intact first. And once that was cleared up, then we could go around the other damages, which you know, in some instances was minor. I suppose the most worrying one at the time was the hole in the stern of the ship, because once we got out of the river, if we did get out of the river, then we might probably take in water there, you know, if we encountered rough seas or anything like that. But that was the most harrowing one, I suppose.
Was it easy to do the repairs, or were there things that you lacked in order to be able to do them properly?
No, we had, you know, a few spares and that on board, but you could utilize, you know, a lot of things to repair them with. Luckily, we had quite a bit of damage on the freshwater systems, on the water systems of the ship, especially on the upper deck. And we were able to get hoses and used, like, they didn't call them Jubilee clips in there, but we were able to use clips to join them together with rubber hoses and things like that on the vital parts that we would need at that particular time. But I think one of the main things we were concerned with at the time was fuel, because when Commander Cairns took over, he sent for me to find out what the fuel situation was, which we did have at the time of the incident, because the auxiliary steam was kept up from April the 20th to May the 21st, when we had 179 tons left furnace fuel and diesel left. And fuel expended at an average 6.6 tons a day. That means to say that you kept up to supply fans and evaporators to make fresh water, and for the refrigeration plant and that to keep going. Well, it was then decided to raise auxiliary steam for only about 12 hours daily to make water, pump out compartments for ventilation and communications, and to run the refrigerators. This was done until June the 15th, by which date fuel was down to 106 tonnes all told. Expenditure during this period had averaged less than 3 tonnes a day, so we cut it by half then. It now began a period from June the 15th to July the 10th, when steam was raised every other day, and sometimes every third day. By July the 10th, 62 tonnes of fuel, furnace fuel, and 9.8 tonnes of diesel remained. For this period, consumption had been about 1 tonne a day. This in midsummer in the Yangtze was a most trying time, because we had to rig an emergency hand pump for the toilets, which we used, we sucked from the Yangtze, rigged up an emergency hand pump, so every time you went to the toilet and that, you used the hand pump to flush instead of using a normal fresh water. Other instances was we just, if Commander Carries in an important signal to send, then naturally we had to flash up if the batteries were low, and little instances like that. And on July the 10th, after considerable negotiations, 54 tonnes of furnace fuel was received from Hoji at Nanking, because we were down to, as I say, 62 tonnes. And Commander Cairns asked me what he thought my loss of suction would be in the fuel tanks. Well, I anticipated round about 20 tonnes. That's in, because you've got several fuel tanks, and of course naturally you've got to allow for loss of suction where the pipe doesn't go right down to the bottom. So he asked during his negotiations with the Chinese authorities, when we used to go ashore and negotiate with them, could he have fuel? Well, after several months, a terrible time, he said, all right, we'll send you some fuel. Well, when the fuel arrived, little did we realise that it was a junk with 294 drums, that's 45-gallon drums, of fuel. Fuel at those was black and terrible, you know, and it was 294 drums. And we thought, goodness me, you know, so Commander Cairns sent for me, he said, how can you, you know, unload all this lot? So I got together with the rest of the ship's company, and we organised, because we had three filling positions on the ship. I had to make quick, hurried ramps so that you brought the drums aboard. We brought them by the ship's derricks, brought them on board. And you got the filling cap of the drum, and as you rolled the drum up, the filling cap was underneath, and we had to make up funnels which went down to the filling positions. So each drum of 294 had to be poured into the tanks that way, whereas normally it's done by high pressure hose and everything. So we worked in two shifts. One shift went on for quite a few hours, and then another shift went on to take the rest of the time. And then after you'd empty the drum, they had to be stowed aft, and then once all the drums had been used, all the drums had to be loaded back onto the junk. And it was this fill which was eventually to enable Amethyst to escape. One can imagine how our invigilators feel about that now. It's just going. This is going by the 294 drums of fill were struck down below into tanks in 11 hours from 04 in the morning, which just started to get light, to 1600 at night. As I've said before, each drum had to be hoisted inboard and rolled to its filling position. All three filling positions were utilised, and a semi-rotary pump and hoses being rigged to the forward one, and wooden cradles with ramps and funnels on the other two positions. All available hands took part in two watches so as to complete this operation. And there's once again steam was raised daily for about 12 hours until July the 24th, when a typhoon warning was received at that particular time.
So obviously it was very hard work.
Oh yes, yes, that was the most trying time. That was the most trying time. And at that particular time, when the typhoon warning was received, a second anchor was dropped, and we raised main steam because naturally the Yangtze had a bit of 6-knot current flowing down the Yangtze. And so we had to drop a second anchor that particular time, and Commander Cairns ordered main steam to be raised. And the captain prepared to run for it if the anchors dragged or the cable parted. However, the ship rode it out all right. And the captain actually kept a blackboard in his cabin on which was chalked daily the quantities of important stores and fill remaining. On the night of July the 30th, negotiations having bogged down, the captain decided to attempt the breakout, the fill remaining being 43.3 tons left. And he'd asked me at that particular time what fill he would be required to get out of the Yangtze, and I anticipated maybe just about 50 ton. And when we got out, we had 7 ton left when we reached the HMS Concorde, when we eventually reached during the escape.
So it had actually taken about 36 tons, 37 tons.
Yeah. And, you know, if we'd have been left up there any longer, then we would have naturally, we wouldn't have had enough fuel anyway. And don't forget that when we left, after we left, and we started to come down the Yangtze, we steamed at full power all the time, which was unusual again, you know, which was what, because we got it next morning, which was about 10 hours, I think, steaming at full power again, which is so unusual on a Navy ship. And we'd already had 10 hours of previous 3 months before. And of course, at that particular time, we had a lot of brickwork which was down in the boilers, and we'd repaired the brickwork in the boilers, but we'd run out of bricks then, so we had to depend that the repair work we'd done would hold, you know. And fortunately, it did.
You mean some of the bricks had collapsed?
Collapsed in the boilers, yeah.
Because of the gunfire?
Well, no, because of the the wear and tear. Of full power all the time. So we were very fortunate, very, very fortunate. When you think back now, to think that, you know, what you went through, because normally, as I said, you know, I keep saying quite often, full power is not used, only in very, very emergency. And that's only for, say, for a few minutes.